Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 195 of Caropop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is Emma Swift, sublime singer, songwriter, and interpreter of other songs, who also runs her and her husband's record label. Swift is a native Australian who for many years has lived in Nashville with London native Robin Hitchcock. As the organized member of this couple, she does most of the heavy lifting for their label, Tiny Ghost Records. On September 12th, that label released her latest album, The Resurrection Game. Here comes the rain. I saw Swift perform this summer in the midst of a series of house concerts. Accompanied by a guitarist, she sang stripped-down versions of songs from The Resurrection Game and her previous album of Bob Dylan songs, Blonde on the Tracks. Man in me will do nearly any task. And as for compensation, there's little he would ask. Take a woman like you to get through to the man in me. It was a beautiful, intimate evening. The Resurrection Game is lush, melodic, melancholic, and hopeful. On the standout song, No Happy Endings, she sings, "The world's a spinning time bomb that there's no denying. There are no happy endings, but they've been trying." As she puts it on her Bandcamp page, the songs are about romance, desire, my real-life nervous breakdown, spirituality, hope, and radical self-acceptance. As she says in this conversation, the album is also about the transcendent nature of art and how art can get us through quite brutal experiences by making them beautiful. It is, in other words, what a lot of us need right now. Swift reflects on her musical influences while growing up in Sydney, Australia, and becoming a radio host as well as a musician. She takes us through her move to Nashville and why that city has been a better fit for her in Hitchcock than, say, London. She digs into her songwriting and approach to making albums. In her house concert, she described the new song, Nothing Forever, as being for Hitchcock, whom she describes as surreal and nihilistic. She describes herself as languid and romantic. Have their sensibilities rubbed off on one another? That's you and me. Nothing and forever. Do they sing and write together at home? How did she wind up running their label? She also discusses the underrated aspect of Dylan's writing that she wanted to bring out on Blonde on the Tracks, and she says which Dylan song happens to be the best song ever recorded. Please enjoy this Caropop conversation with Emma Swift.
I fuss with my hair, and I fight blood feuds. I contain multitudes.
So welcome home. When did you get back from this tour? Like yesterday, you said?
I got back yesterday, but it's not by any means the end of tour. It's just it's a short intermission. I've just done a series of dates in the Midwest. So I saw you in Chicago and we played in Fort Wayne, Indiana and Minneapolis and Columbus, Ohio, a bunch of other places. And then I've got a week where I've got two gigs in Nashville and then I head to the East Coast.
And are your gigs in Nashville like clubs or are they also in someone's home or backyard or something like
that? No, there's a club called The Five Spot.
Is this the same band that's on The Resurrection Game?
No.
It's a band of people from, and are you using the same guitarist who you've just been on the road with in the band?
No. How do I explain Nashville?
I was going to say, this is like a Nashville thing where there's so many musicians that you just sort of rotate people in and out.
Well, also, I don't have the money that other musicians have. I'm not Jeff Tweedy. I can't keep a band on a retainer. I have to work with what I can work with. So I think the people that I made the record with are all part of touring ensembles at the moment. So Juan Solazano, who played on my record, he's the main guitarist, the principal guitarist. He's on tour with Shelby Lynn.
Oh, yeah.
And Rustin Kelly, and Dom Billet is the drummer, and he tours a lot with a whole bunch of people. And Jordan Lenning, who also plays on the record, is strictly a producer. He's a house guy. You can't get him out of the house. He's got three kids and a full-time recording studio. So there's no one in the band is part of this show. And then Rick Lawler, who I've been on tour with, is he's got some gigs in Seattle. And then so the band that I've got is really fantastic. Jamie Davis is the lead guitarist. People might have seen him play with Margot Price. And the bass player is my friend Kevin Black, and he plays with Sturgill Simpson. So Sturgill and Kevin just opened for Grateful Dead last week in San Francisco. Now Kevin's going to come back to Nashville and play a club show with me. So that's kind of fun.
Is that one of the key advantages of being in Nashville, is that you just have this pool of really talented musicians around?
Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly why I live here. I can't imagine living anywhere else. I mean, not only is it just so many talented people who all play music, but it's also pretty centrally located. So it's easy.
Right.
It's easy to get places.
Chicago's yeah. pretty centrally located too, but Nashville, I know has more of a music industry than we do. Not that I'm comparing. So when you get back from doing the kind of shows you were just doing, and again, the one I saw in Chicago was wonderful. You had two nights here, both sold out. One, I think, was outdoor in a backyard. The one I saw was in someone's wonderful living room with these great windows behind you and everything else. Does it recharge you? Does it exhaust you? Is it all of the above? Like, how do you sort of process this kind of, you know, intimate, you know, performing experience?
Oh, it's really, it's a lovely way to spend the summer. I've been having a great time. They're pretty intimate shows. So I think the most people that we played to was probably 100 people in Minneapolis in a quite large backyard space. But over two nights in Chicago, it was 40 people apiece. And it's pretty energizing. You know, it's a lot of fun. I've got a lot going on at the moment. These shows are coinciding with my album release, The Resurrection Game. So I'm playing a lot of shows and doing a lot of promo and doing a thing that I like to call feeding the content beast,
right,
which is just basically me trying to keep up with all the various social media and trying to get people as aware of the record as I can be, because I'm also my own record label. So I wear a lot of hats.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you're turning this over to the publicity team now and the marketing team and the A&R team and all of that. And then it's just like you in another room or something, right?
I do have a publicist, and I do have a guy that helps me with radio as well. But so I'm not a complete lone wolf. I'd be lying if I said that. But because I'm the record label, yeah, I am the A&R. I'm the chief. And that has advantages and disadvantages.
So, tell me what the advantages and disadvantages are. I mean, I could guess that
the advantages are that I get to do whatever the hell I like. So there's no one saying this record isn't commercial enough or marketable enough. I mean, or anything like that. It's very much an album that I made with my own. I made an album that sounds like something I would like to hear. It's pretty old-fashioned. It's got decadent string arrangements.
Oh, yeah.
They're kind of very old-fashioned folk songs in a way, like the very traditional song structures. But the instrumentation is like something on a Harry Nilsson record or a Scott Walker record. And I love those old albums. And then on top of that, though, I'm prone to, and I don't know if it's because I've listened to too much Gillian Welch or Neil Young or Bob Dylan, but I love a long song. And most record labels, I think, would encourage their artists to err on the side of 3 minutes, because radio stations don't like to play things that go for longer than 3 minutes. But my tracks are a bit more indulgent as far as time goes. So that's the advantage, is that I don't have to listen to it. I can just make whatever I like.
Well,
the disadvantage is are that, you know, like I'm funding it all myself. So it's being a musician is so much like being a gambler. Right. I'm always saying to people that, you know, like, yeah, it's regular people do things around the house, renovate bathrooms, go on vacations, and musicians just take their savings and then make albums.
Well, I mean, I'll say that as someone who has sort of tried juggling creative and commercial stuff at various points as well, you know, you're making an album like this, which, you know, sounds very personal. Obviously, any music you're making is going to be very personal, from the lyrics to how you're singing it to the arrangements and everything else. And then you got to put on this other hat where you're dealing with this sort of cold world of like numbers and, I don't know, this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, is it hard to not take personally the business side of it because the creative part of it is so personal?
I've become much more philosophical, I think, than I used to be about the process of putting out music. And as I get older, I'm just more and more grateful that I get to do it. And so I don't get as fazed by numbers or metrics, or because if I was fazed by those kinds of things, I think I'd make a completely different type of music. You know, if I really cared about getting those numbers up, I would probably make something that had more commercial appeal. But I've made something that I like. And that is, to me, the true measure of success is, do I like this thing? Am I proud to put it out? And I do on both counts.
Are you someone, though, like when you release a song, whether it's on YouTube or Spotify or wherever, do you kind of obsessively like check the numbers and see how many people have listened to it? Or are you able to sort of get it out there and then just be like, okay, it's out in the world, but I'm not going to keep too much of tabs on it?
I do like to check back in, but mostly on a platform like YouTube, the reason that I check back in is so I can reply to the comments. Mm. You know, if someone has said something nice, I can write back. If someone has said something scathing, I can block them. You know, I actually don't get many nasty comments on YouTube, but that's the reason for checking in on that. And then I do check in on my streaming numbers because, you know, I have to go to promoters and other people and apply for, like, so I just applied for a festival next year, and you have to present festivals with your numbers. So it is something you can't, I'm not in a privileged enough position to kind of totally get away with not being aware of those things. And then there's also the horrible comparison trap that you get into artistically, which I try to stay away from that as much as possible, that, oh, you know, I'll just go and see how many numbers my friend is streaming or whatever. And, you know, like, you do get curious about that stuff because you have to be, you know, I'm still running a business. I have to work out how many streams are going to make up my check for $27 from Spotify.
Yeah. I mean, the songs on the album I remember them being sort of mostly in the 4 and 5 minute. It's not like the era of the 3 minute single is still upon us anyway, because it's like commercial radio is just such a different beast than, I mean, I'm older than you are, but we both grew up listening to music differently than I think people listen to it now. And, you know, and one good thing is that there's more of an album market again for, like, you know, but getting that vinyl record that you're gonna, you know, sell. And, you know, it's maybe not as much driven by, I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about. You know a lot more about this than I do, but I would hope that it's like that, you know, the type of musician you are is going to appeal to people who want that kind of music.
Oh, I think so. And I think there are a lot of people who do like the kind of music that I make, you know. It's very much I'm very much the product of someone who grew up listening to 90s indie rock with 70s and 60s kind of classic rock thrown in, and then a little bit of jazz just to kind of balance things out. That's sort of what swirls around in my psyche. And I mean, when I go to make a record too, like, there are other artists at the moment who they're just recording singles, and then they'll package them together eventually as an album, maybe. But for me, I go into each project thinking of it as an album project. And that means I'm thinking about two sides of a record, two side A.
Right. Okay.
I also am aware that, you know, there's a limitation in terms of how long an album can go for. Generally, it's about 40 minutes is what you want for an album just to keep up with the quality of vinyl. Of course, when I was growing up, I was growing up in the 90s and CDs started getting really long.
Right. Then. And albums got worse for it too. Like I think the return of vinyl is a good thing for music, because I'd rather listen to a 40-minute record than a, you know, 65-minute record, you know, unless it's like a, you know, Blonde on Blonde, one that you like, unless it's like specifically a double album. When it's just a single album that just goes on too long, it's like, I don't know. There are bands that you could sort of go through their discography and think that sort of they dipped a little when the CDs came around.
Right. Well, I mean, your limitations are your strengths, you know, I think that it's good. It's certainly for me, it's good for me to have, because I'm a kind of free-ranging person, a freewheeling spirit, and it's good for me to have some kind of imposed structure on the format.
So when you set out to write the songs for The Resurrection Game, did you have an idea of, this is like the kind of album I want to write and it's going to have this kind of unified feel and these kind of arrangements? Or was it more that you were writing songs and as they came together, you started thinking, oh, this is sort of the direction I'm going in?
Yeah, that, it's more like the latter, I would say. And I mean, there are whole songs that didn't make this album that were still recorded in those sessions, but they just didn't fit. They didn't fit the project. I still think that some of them are pretty good. I like them, but I couldn't find a way to make them work on The Resurrection Game, so I left them off.
So that was more of a conceptual thing than like, these are the less good. These are the songs that would have fit on the CD.
It was more that sonically they didn't fit. The album started to have quite a contemplative, sorrowful mood, and I didn't want to break that up by putting in something too kind of rock and roll. I want the album to be something that people can marinate in, rather than when a song jumps out in a record because it doesn't fit, that was not something I wanted to happen.
Do these songs represent sort of a clear kind of period of your life, that they were all sort of written within a certain circumstances, as opposed to, you know, you had this one kicking around for a few years and came back to it and, you know, sort of made it all work together thematically?
I think that there's a lot of the songs are, basically it's a record about love and loss and loneliness and longing, and ultimately about the transcendent nature of art and how art can get us through quite brutal experiences by making them beautiful. So some of the tracks on the record, like The Resurrection Game, for example, is that was born out of me going to a therapy camp in California, where you write about your parents' patterns, and then you have to beat those patterns with a plastic yellow wiffle bat.
Wow.
And say, I'm not my mother and father's patterns. And so The Resurrection Game is a little bit about me being born again as an adult human after that experience, having really addressed, you know, some of the stuff I had going on with my mom and dad. You know, my dad died when I was 21 and I'm in my early 40s now. And so I never really got to be an adult with him. And The Resurrection Game is about that, for example, where the song Nothing and Forever is a love song that I wrote for my husband, who is also a songwriter. But his songs are he's a very funny songwriter. He writes quite sad songs at times too, but he's very funny and surreal. And I'm a more languid, romantic person. But his nihilism has kind of tainted me. and nothing and forever is a little bit about that. It's, you know, like this is, you know, in your eyes, this is nothing, but it's also in my eyes forever. so that's a love song, you know.
I think it might have been in introduction to that song in Chicago, or you said I'm married to a surrealist and nihilist, and some of that had rubbed off on me. And I hadn't thought of Robin Hitchcock being a nihilist, but I hadn't really analyzed it that much, and you would know better than I would on that. But I thought that was an interesting comment.
I mean, I think he's kind of a nihilist in a very jokey way. Like I think he uses it for humorous purposes. But he's sort of, you know, and maybe it's not nihilism so much as like where I'm a very optimistic and warm person, he's quite cynical. He's like, we're all doomed, babe, party, you know.
Right.
Whereas I tend to have a more hopeful outlook, which is really, you know, given the times that we're living in right now, that's a pretty challenging place to be. And then again, that's kind of a recurring theme on this record too. Like the first single, No Happy Endings, is there are no happy endings, but baby, I'm trying, you know, right. Like, and that is about, you know, like, because all of these songs were written in a kind of post-Trump world, which when he was first elected, I lost a lot of my innocence when that happened. I didn't think that someone so truly repugnant could be an elected official. I was very naive. And
I think a lot of people change the way they view humankind after that.
Yeah. And that changing the way that I view humankind, or that radical reassessment of our species, did cause a profound sadness in me that is sort of embedded in this record. There is sorrow in this album. You know, it's, but I've always, that, you know, like I've always liked to sing sad songs, you know, like I taught myself to sing listening to Linda Ronstadt records, because that's what my dad had lying around. And I, you know, I grew up in the 90s listening to Sinead O'Connor and the Sundays and the Cranberries. And I just love those sad, sad lady singers.
Yeah. No, I actually wrote down these lyrics were from No Happy Endings, where he said, the world's a spinning time bomb, that there's no denying, there are no happy endings, but baby, I've been trying. But that feeling of the world being a spinning time bomb, I think, sadly, is something a lot of people relate to. And it's a beautiful song. And I remember, again, you playing it in Chicago, but then also I've listened to it on, you know, the album. And, you know, it's one of those things where you have this, on one hand, this fear and, you know, feeling of gloom, right? But then you also have this kind of elevating power of beauty, which the song is, as well as the sentiment in the song. It's not even a question.
Yeah. I'm glad you've enjoyed listening to it. You know, it's, yeah. I mean, to me, I love all the creative arts. You know, I love going to the theater. I love visiting art galleries. I mean, when I was in Chicago, you know, chance to go and see some fantastic visual art is wonderful. But music to me has just always been this great connector and profound healer. You know, like there's nothing more enjoyable for me than to go and see a show. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I imagine if I was, maybe that's what people get out of church. I get out of going to gigs.
does writing music and performing music as well as listening to music, does that have like a therapeutic, you know, value for you where, you know, if you're feeling down, this is like the thing that can kind of pull you out of it or helps pull you out of it?
I don't actually know if it does. All I know is that, you know, it's just something I've always really loved to do. I don't know that, I know that I feel better for it. But sometimes I think, you know, actually writing a song is a little bit more like picking at a wound, you know, it doesn't necessarily make you feel better to kind of go down into the abyss and see what you can pull up. But I do know that I like writing songs. I enjoy the process, and there's something kind of mysterious and magical about it too. I don't know where these melodies come from or these ideas come from. And it's, there's something very meditative about the process.
This is the sort of a songwriting 101 question, but how do you write? Do you sit with a guitar? Do you sit with a pen and paper? How do you do it?
I don't have any rules. I travel a lot. So I've written songs on planes when I've just had the notes app of my phone open and I've got an idea and then I'm just going to go and do that. I'll write the lyrics down that way I'll sit down at the piano and play. I do handwrite. I've semi-completed Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way several times. that's pretty helpful too. I really like writing with pen and paper, though I've got appalling handwriting. It can't be as bad as mine.
No, it can't be as bad as mine. Does a song tend to start with like a phrase or an idea or maybe like a musical hook or something?
Like I said, there's no rules.
It's just whatever comes.
Sometimes I will be, if I get a melody, sometimes I'll be at a gig and that will trigger an idea for a melody. And so I'll have to go off to the bathroom and just sing something into my phone and usually just singing mumbo jumbo just to get the melody down. And then other times I work off titles in my phone. So I keep a rolling list of titles and I'll intentionally sit down with the guitar and I'll go, okay, here's this title, no happy endings, and then have a strum and see what comes out. I do like the mystery of that approach. I would say that makes me pretty undisciplined and also not very prolific. But that's the way that I do it. I try not to put too much pressure on myself as well. I think it's when I was younger, I used to put an enormous amount of pressure on myself to kind of get things done, be a real workhorse. And now I try to have a much more leisurely approach.
Well, you never know when it's going to, when the alchemy is going to happen. So it's a very part of what I think is so wonderful about songwriting and music is that it can come from anywhere and you don't know when it's going to come. And if it was just a science where you thought, okay, I'm just going to sit down for an hour today and I'm going to come up with like a hook and a chorus or something, it wouldn't be the same.
Well, I think, I mean, there's that thing though, that Nick Cave, my fellow countryman, says, you know, like it's not going to show up if you don't show up.
Right.
You know, so if you pick up the guitar every day rather than sort of, I don't know, bed rot or watch TV or, you know, go to the bar, if you pick up the guitar, then something is more inclined to come to you.
So I saw Tony Kushner, the playwright, interviewed years ago, and he said something that really stuck with me. He said, writing is a physical activity. Like you can't just sort of do it all in your head. The thing that happens when you actually sit down and write, whether you're writing with a pen or on your typewriter or on your guitar or whatever else, but it's the physical act of writing is the key to writing. And I thought that's a good point. Even if you might get the inspiration while you're taking a bike ride or something.
Totally. I get a lot of inspiration in the shower as well. I'll have a cup of coffee in the shower and I'll get ideas. But, you know, I'm also, like we were talking about at the top of the podcast, like I am a small business person who runs a record label. So I can go weeks where I'm not writing songs because I'm shipping out vinyl and t-shirts and, you know, I'm on tour. Like I find it very difficult to write when I'm on tour because the process of writing is a kind of introverted experience and the touring is an extroverted experience. So they're different. They're fish swimming in opposite directions.
Mm. Yeah, I told you that I'd bought the bubblegum vinyl version of Underwater Moonlight, which is, you know, the Soft Boys made by, you know, with, you know, the front man is your husband. And I was very eager to get it because it looked like it was, you know, it had done from the original master tapes and everything else. And you said, oh, yeah, I mailed that to you. Like you were the one who actually mailed it to me. So you are the label. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of responsibility on top of everything else.
Well, it's fun. It's a fun job. You know, it's a good day job. It's a great day job to have.
So something like Underwater Moonlight, are you the one who's arranging the mastering engineers and all of those details as well?
Yeah. Yeah. I work with Robin on that too, but I mean, Robin is, if anybody's ever been to a Robin Hitchcock show or listened to any of his music, they'll have a fairly accurate understanding of what he's like as a person when it comes to the practicalities of the day-to-day, which is my way of saying he's not at all. We work on these things together, which is fun. You know,
you complement his skill set.
Yeah. And it's sort of like in the contemporary music business, it's kind of a necessity, you know, like the income from musicians has been completely decimated by streaming. A lot of the artists that I know run their own record labels. It's not unusual. And some of those artists are also just like really successful. They just like having their own label. So Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings have their own label. You know, they put out their stuff. And I admire that enormously. Jason Isbell also puts out his own records on Southeastern. I think there's a lot to be said for doing that. But it's not without challenges either. You know, certainly one of the challenges that I have the most is like, so I'm trying to write the record to follow up the Resurrection Game. And I don't know when I'm going to find the time to go and do that.
The writing or to do the everything else?
The writing for that record because I'm on tour for the next couple of months and then I'll go on tour with Robin and you know, like trying to make time for that is we'll see. I have a fantasy, a Bon Iver inspired fantasy, and when he put out his first record for Emma forever ago, you know, was the name of that album. And when he put that album out, a lot of the talk about that was how he had gone to a cabin in the woods, sort of romantically locked himself away and wrote these terribly sad, beautiful breakup songs. And I don't want to have a terribly sad breakup, but I do want to go and spend some time in a cabin in the woods with just me and my guitar and see what happens.
Do you and Robin like write at the same time in different rooms or do you have to sort of have space away from that?
Sometimes we do. We actually both prefer, we're quite independent individuals, even though we work together a lot and we travel together a lot. And so we both kind of enjoy it when the other goes away. I know he's been absolutely thrilled that I've been on tour and my guitarist Rick Lawler is playing with me. And so Robin doesn't have to be at any of these shows or do anything. And I know that's when I'm gone, that's a creatively fruitful time for him because I'm not there. And the same goes for him. You know, I tend to write songs when he is out of the house. And it goes both ways.
Do you two sit down and just say, hey, let's write a song together?
Not really. We're working on an album of duets together, but most of those songs have been started by Robin. And then I come in and add either lyrical ideas or change the melody or bring in a bridge. We tend to work together in that way, rather than finishing each other's ideas, starting with a blank canvas going, hey. I mean, we've tried to do that before and it wasn't fun. I don't know if it's a birth order thing. We're both eldest children. He's the oldest of three and I'm the oldest of seven.
Mm.
And so I think that there's a part of us that just wants to go and be by ourselves, you know,
right.
Do the thing and then come back, you know, and say, hey, here's what I've done.
Do you feel like your each of your sensibilities has rubbed off on the other artistically at all?
I don't know. I mean, I would say probably. I think we've broadened each other's listening tastes, but we both very much like very similar things. So in my universe, I like, like I was saying earlier, like indie rock and sort of classic albums of the 60s and 70s. And so, but the thing with, and Robin also, like, you know, like we both love the Beatles and we both love Lou Reed, but where he goes into Captain Beefheart and Syd Barrett, I go into, you know, Neil Young and Linda Ronstadt. So my taste is probably straighter than his.
You both love Dylan.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Bob Dylan is a huge figure in both our lives for different reasons, I think. You know, Robin came across Bob Dylan when he was a 14-year-old schoolboy. I first heard of Bob Dylan when he was like the kind of older, grumpy looking guy in the Traveling Wilburys. And I was like seven when that was happening. So, you know, it's Bob Dylan, we found Bob Dylan at different ages and stages, but we're both enormously inspired by him as an artist.
Do you two have different Dylans that you think is the best? Like, you think Visions of Johanna is the best song ever recorded. Would that be his, or would he choose some other area of Dylan?
Oh, no, we both agree on Visions of Johanna. But then after that, it starts to get varied, you know. I'm a very big fan of Infidels, for example. And that is perhaps because Infidels came out the year I was born, and I have a romantic attachment to that. I just came back from tour and I'd been to all of these fantastic record stores, and a particularly good one was in Mankato in Minnesota. And naturally, because, you know, Bob Dylan's born in Minnesota and the Minnesotans really love Dylan. And I picked up Empire Burlesque on vinyl and I got Greatest Hits Volume 2 on cassette, which I was really happy about. And I came, and I've also got a bunch of other records. I picked up Elliott Smith. I got Lou Reed, New Sensations, some Brian Eno. Like I visited a lot of record stores and I came home with the spoils last night and I showed Robin and he was really excited, you know, particularly excited to see the Greatest Hits 2 on cassette, because he listens to cassettes in his office.
Do you listen mostly to vinyl?
Mostly to vinyl. Yeah. He has a cassette player in his office and I have a record deck in mine.
Did you try recording Visions of Johanna, by the way, or cause that's not on Blonde on the Tracks, or did you think, no, you know what, I'm just going to leave that one alone?
Well, I originally wanted to leave it alone because Marianne Faithfull had recorded it. Marianne Faithfull was one of my favorite singers. And, I admire her immensely. And I think she made some really brave and fascinating, cool career choices over the course of her life. And she had recorded Visions of Johanna. And so I decided not to put it on Blonde on the Tracks. And instead I put Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, which is probably my second favorite Bob Dylan song. But when I started to play these Dylan songs live, Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands goes for 11 minutes and 58 seconds. And so it's just, I could do it and I probably should, but it's like running a marathon. So I started doing Visions of Johanna. And now I do have plans to record Visions of Johanna. I don't know if it will be part of another Dylan album or if it will be a standalone single, because people kind of ask me about Visions now. So I feel like I really should get it recorded sooner rather than later. So it'll probably be a standalone single that might get added onto an album down the line.
I love your version of Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, by the way. It's really gorgeous. And I think that it's something I love about that album in general, and that Dylan, I think because of his voice and just, you know, his unique way of delivering everything, you sort of pay a lot of attention to the lyrics and how he's spinning them. And sometimes you lose sight of, not that you can lose sight of something that you're listening to, but you lose track of how beautiful some of the melodies are. And I think you really sort of bring those out on that album while also still kind of getting at the emotions of those songs.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think that Dylan is a wonderful, truly gifted writer of melodies. And I think that because he's such a brilliant lyricist, and everybody talks about the lyrics, that sometimes the melodies and his skill there gets overlooked. And so in part, Blonde on the Tracks was an exercise in celebrating how glorious the melodies are. I mean, they're just wonderful to sing. You know, it's really, it's a gift to be able, for him to be able to write like that. And then to hand those songs down, you know, as a singer, there's nothing more enjoyable than a great melody to climb. And he certainly does that because of the way that his voice is, you know, particularly in that 60s run of like sort of feisty and bitter and angry around that period, you know, like the pre-Lady Lay smooth Nashville voice that he gets going, because you know he's got multiple voices, he's pretty mercurial, but what I was trying to do when singing these songs is kind of unearth the tenderness that's actually there. There's real beauty to be found.
Did immersing yourself in Dylan that way affect or inspire how you were writing songs and approaching songs after that?
I don't think so, because Bob Dylan's an immensely different songwriter to me. You know, he's a total, his songs are like paintings, you know, there's so much detail, and I'm a much simpler songwriter, my language is very direct, very direct, very confessional. I'm more inspired in the writing by, you know, poets like Robert Lowell or Sylvia Plath or stuff like that's more my, the touchstones that I'm going to. I mean, you know, the Gemini who's had the most influence on my songwriting is actually probably Morrissey. Which is, it's difficult to say because he's not the most lovable person. but the songs that he wrote have been incredibly inspiring to me as a songwriter.
If I show you my truth, then will you show me yours?
How did growing up in Australia and Sydney sort of shape the way you approached music? Like, is there any way you could kind of pinpoint that in terms of what you were exposed to and how immersed you were in music before then you moved to the, what, you were moved to the States at that point or to England? I think to the States.
I moved to the States in 2012. And basically I moved to the States because I'd been hosting a Americana alternative country kind of folk radio show. So the bands that I was playing on that show were, you know, Wilco or Bill Callahan or Nico Case, that kind of music. But someone had sent me an Australian record label, I think, had reissued Grand Old Opry DVDs and Porter Wagner DVDs. And so I started to get into, for the first time, classic country and kind of Graham Parsons and, you know, Emmylou Harris, but also Tammy Wynette, Dolly Parton, Patsy Cline. And because I started to get into that stuff, I really felt inspired to visit Nashville. I was like, I'm going to go to Nashville. It's going to be great. And I just came over here and I loved it. And so I found a way to move. As for the Australian cultural experience, I mean, I grew up just listening to what my parents had. And my parents were into, you know, Paul Kelly and Billy Bragg and that kind of stuff. So, that was pretty influential for me as a young musician.
How has being in Nashville affected what you do also? I mean, have you been inspired by what you're around?
You can't help but be inspired by being in Nashville. It's such a fun city. It's so creative. It's so weird. People project a lot of ideas onto Nashville. In that they think, oh, it's just country music. And I got a review once on my first EP that I put out, and the reviewer was an Australian reviewer who had clearly never been to America. They said, oh, you know, it's pretty good for an album made in Nashville. And I just thought, okay, that's like just so offensive to the history of recorded music. But, you know, I think, yeah, Nashville's, you know, it's pretty eclectic. There's some pretty good stuff happening here all the time.
There's like a couple different Nashvilles. There's like Nashville, like there's Hollywood, which sort of represents the specific industry, which is sort of this very commercial. And then there's Nashville, the city that has like all these, you know, musicians, including you and Robin and Brendan Benson and, you know, all these other eclectic, you know, talents that are together in one place because that's where the music is.
Yeah, it's and I love being here because I think that keeps me making music. It keeps me inspired. It keeps me hopeful. If I lived in a city like Sydney still, I would be forced, because Sydney is so expensive in the first place, but I'd have to have a straight job as well as doing the music. Because there's not enough work in Australia for someone like me. Like I'm about to, the tour that I'm in the middle of has, I think it's about 33 shows, if you include the two dates that I'm doing in Nashville. And I couldn't play 33 shows in Australia. There wouldn't be 33 shows to play because we don't have the population to sustain it. But I do love going back there. You know, it's an absolutely beautiful country. It's just so far away, you know.
And you spent time in England too, but did not want to stay in England.
Well, England is, by the time I got to England, it was a little bit like trying to start my life again. And having, you know, I moved to Sydney to go to college when I was 18. I moved to Nashville to pursue music when I was 30. Going to London and starting again, I'd kind of got a bit too old, I think, to do that. And I'm not that I, you know, I'm not necessarily like afraid of getting older, but I just didn't want to start my life from the ground up again. You start to, as you get older, you start to value those really long-term relationships and friendships and work colleagues. And trying to, I did try London on for size, and then we had to stay there a little bit longer than was probably good for me for family reasons. And you know, it's a fantastic country and a really truly beautiful place with an incredible music history. But it's also a little bit cold, a little bit damp, and London is just like insanely expensive for a musician to live in as a city. And it's also, London is, it's like the opposite of Nashville. Like we were talking about earlier, how Nashville's so central. So you can drive 4 hours and you're in Cincinnati, or you drive 7 hours and you're in Chicago, or get on a plane and you're in New York in 2 hours. But in London, just to play a gig anywhere else, like getting to Heathrow is a nightmare. You know,
if you have your instruments, especially.
Exactly.
So, are you in Nashville to stay? Is this like that's your home?
I don't know. I love Nashville. I'd like to stay in Nashville. I don't know if I'll be here forever because I, you know, anything could happen. It's certainly the right place for right now.
During the pandemic, you guys were, you know, active and doing things online and sort of staying connected musically with people. What was that like, and how much did that whole just period just kind of take out of you?
Well, the pandemic was really interesting for me in terms of self-discovery, in that I've always thought of myself as a kind of, you know, extroverted, outgoing person who likes to go places and do things. And actually, when I couldn't go anywhere and I was cut off from the world, and this goes back to that cabin in the woods idea too, is that the early phase of the pandemic was very creatively fruitful for me because I no longer had this compulsive need to leave the house. I couldn't leave the house. And because I couldn't, I started the record label. I released the Blonde on the Tracks album. I helped Robin put together his Shuffle Mania record. I then put together a book of his selected lyrics. We started these live stream shows, which we still do. So it was a pretty productive time. You know, I also went quietly mad. I mean, not clinically mad. I was fine. I have been clinically mad, but not that would come later. But you know, like we were really lucky in so many ways because so many of the existing audience that Robin had and that I had on a much smaller scale than him really supported us and just showered us with love and kindness. And, you know, they bought vinyl, they bought CDs, they came to the live streams, you know, they kept us employed. And we're so fortunate for that, because I really don't know what would have happened if we weren't able to do that, you know.
Right. Yeah, no, technology was your friend. And look, we're doing this on Zoom. I'd never been on Zoom before the pandemic. I didn't know what Zoom was. And,
right.
You know, and
how did you do with the pandemic? How did you fare?
I have no idea. I still haven't figured it out. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I thought I was doing all right. And then a lot of stuff dried up. And I'm still trying to bounce back from it. But, it was important for me to get out and go on walks. That's for sure. Just getting out of the house, getting outside, because I'm someone who does not like to just be cooped up all the time. But it was good to, you know, sort of force yourself to focus for a little bit And it's always good to then have things that maybe you took for granted that you no longer take for granted, like going to a restaurant around people who you like. And I would walk to the neighborhood record store because I really like the people there. And I put on my mask and I just like walk there as my like one time outside just so I could have some connection to talk to people about stuff that I love that isn't, you know, talking about what's going on in the country, which we're kind of at again, but we don't have to wear masks as much. So.
Yeah,
but there's also still that sort of looming, like, oh my God, you know, we're trying to sort of get on with our cheerful lives, but there's also this kind of these really dark clouds that are hanging lower and lower, and you're like, I don't know, like, how much can you compartmentalize everything? That's a whole other issue. Do you find yourself paying attention to the news, and are you affected by like in what you're trying to do? Is the stuff going on in the country or the world, does that affect your sensibility, or are you able to kind of separate things enough to do what you like to do?
Well, I spent all of my 20s as a professional newsreader. So I've been part of the media cycle, you know. When I was, you know, 22, 23, I would eat news for breakfast, have it for lunch, and then have it for dinner as well. I was very, very obsessed with news and current affairs in my 20s when I was a journalist. And now I am not as obsessed. I really don't like the concept of a 24-hour news cycle. I don't think as human beings we are, and maybe the younger generation, as they're kind of, you know, you get born and you're given an iPad. Maybe their brains are developing in a way that can kind of cope with it. But I prefer to consume my news more like on a weekly basis. Like I'll get a weekly magazine, I'll read The New Yorker, I'll read The Atlantic. I try not to know about stuff as it's happening, because I think that when I do, you know, I can be, you know, I can get addicted to knowing what's happening. And when I do, that kind of puts me in a fight or flight trauma response state of being that's really, really unhealthy for me. So I try to know what I need to know and filter out the rest.
I enjoyed you introducing your song Impossible Air and talking about how you really loved the Wilco song Impossible Germany and decided you needed to do an Impossible song.
Yeah, it had always been on my bucket list, you know. I mean, the Blonde on the Tracks record I made with Patrick Sansone from Wilco.
Right.
He's in Tweedy's band. And I didn't work with him on this follow-up record, The Resurrection Game. But, yeah, there's some words that are just so glorious to sing, and Impossible is one of them. I was like, oh yeah, that's, you know, it floats, you know, some words are fun to say.
Do you have any other words you're trying to work into the next record?
Yeah. I've got a track I've got a title, cause I often have titles running around, and this is a Dylan thing. I really want to use the word subterranean on my next record. I'd like to have subterranean in there.
So you're not sure of the phrase yet. You just know the word's going to be in there.
I know the phrase, but I'm not going to say it because I don't want to give too much away.
All right.
Sometimes if you give too much away, it curses the project and it makes it not happen.
And if someone else wrote a song with that phrase, you'd be like, damn it. So
that that's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, the vast listenership of people are waiting to write that song, but we should, yeah.
Well,
we should.
You never know. Like, people are magpies.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, so, I mean, we haven't even talked on like the thing that I'm wrestling with the most in the news cycle is just at the moment is the AI kind of creep. And I really don't like it. You've got to be careful what you put out. Like, I did a songwriting course earlier this year online. And it was with Brian Eno.
Oh, wow.
And it was held over Zoom. And so this is what, you know, one of the wonders of technology. It was me and I think 200 other students all writing songs. And then they, he would give the lecture, the weekly lecture, and then you would go away and you'd write your songs. And then they said, and we've got another extra class where you can share your songs with your fellow students. And I just thought, not for me. If I've got anything good, it's staying with me. Why would I share a song that I've not yet recorded with 199 other people who might find something worth having in this song?
There you go. Well, I was going to say that, like, the AI thing I'm noticing a lot on Facebook, because my feed used to be like my friends, and now there's just like all these other things. And I was going to say this, you're doing something right, because I'm getting your stuff. And in fact, I got a little notice today saying, like, you know, you're one of the people engaging with Emma Swift. And it's like, and it had like a list of like the other people's names. And I wasn't like in the top like 15 even, but I was on there. So I was like, all right, well, that's good. Your stuff is showing up. But there are all these like creepy AI stories where it'll be like, you know, one will be like these sort of like movie trivia things where it'll be like Donald Sutherland wanted a perm when he was making Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And it gets in this whole little anecdote and it says, happy birthday, Donald Sutherland, with like 3 exclamation points, like dead Donald Sutherland can somehow be happy now. And then there was like one that just got posted, which was Paul McCartney was like visiting Phil Collins, and Phil Collins was looking all frail. And so Paul came in and he sang Hey Jude to him. And the picture, and there's this picture of Paul, and he's like playing the guitar right-handed, and the guitar only has 5 strings on it. And it's just total AI bullshit.
Flop. It's, you know, it's, to me, what I really don't like about that stuff is consent. Like, I think, you know, it's one thing, you know, back in the day you could imagine, here's a picture of Paul McCartney and Phil Collins hanging out that I've painted. But now they get these kind of mostly accurate slop likenesses of these people. And the one that I found really particularly grotesque is Rod Stewart. Had a concert, and on the big screen at that concert, they had pictures of a newly ascended to heaven Ozzy Osbourne hanging out with Tupac and Michael Jackson and John Lennon. And to me, that's just absolutely a horrible thing to do. You know, he hadn't even been dead a week, I think.
Right.
And I find that stuff so gross and weird. And I guess because I'm a creative person, so I'm just not even curious about ChatGPT or any of these things. Like, I don't need to know. If I want to imagine something, I tend to imagine something and turn it into a short story or a poem or a song. It's not for me. And maybe that will make me a fuddy-duddy and a Luddite. But I just prefer to kind of not engage.
No, like McCartney's last album, you can hear that he's not 20 anymore. Yet there are versions of songs from that album where they're like, here's, you know, his song, I Don't Know, but sung by younger Paul. And they've like put his voice through some filter so they make it sound like the younger Paul singing it. And I'm just like, and the stuff is going to get harder and harder to kind of tell. And then at some point they'll just be like, well, AI, just write a new Paul song sung by, you know, 1975 Venus and Mars, Paul McCartney and Wings. And, you know, it'll do that. And you'll be like, no, that's not human. But you'll have to waste the time figuring it out.
I just can't. There's just so many better things to do. it's not for me. That's for sure.
Well, it's music like yours that is so personal and beautiful that is going to ward off the robots of AI, because that kind of stuff can't be replicated. So
even if it is replicated, part of the transcendent nature of art is actually the process that you go through to make it. And like, sure, someone could plug into a computer all the things that I've done, like make it sound like they've read this book, but they love this songwriter, and then give it these, you know, Harry Nilsson strings and a touch of the Scott Walkers here and there. And you could do all of that. But none of that is me going to a residential studio on the Isle of Wight for 6 days with, you know, five really awesome people and getting the right drum sound and getting the right guitar sounds and having a laugh and going to the pub after the day's session to have a meal and a pint. And like, you can't replicate that. You can replicate the end product, but you can't replicate the experience that was had making it.
Right.
Just as you could go, you know, Nothing and Forever is a really simple song, but it's inspired by, you know, a marriage that I've been in for 13 years and everything that, that relationship is about. So you can't, someone could completely rip off that song, but they're not going to have the love story that I've had. You know, they don't have the cats and the books and the records and the gigs and the harmony. You know, like, it's that, I think this idea that like that art is born out of plugging input into a machine is it's sort of missing the point of art.
Right. The alchemy is the thing that you can't calculate. You know, you can't just make a, you know, come up with an equation for it, because that's the mystery of music, is like, wait, how did that part of that song become so beautiful that it makes me want to cry? Like, why? You know, I don't know, but it's not something that, you know, a computer did.
Yeah. It's not, or a human with no imagination and a computer did.
Right.
But I don't, you know, and yeah, I think that, you know, it's being widely reported that we're in a loneliness epidemic, and I don't, you know, art is one of the great connecting cool things that you can do. It inspires conversations with people. Like, yeah, I don't know why you would walk away from that opportunity to make friends and be with people. And you know, and it's not always rosy either. You know, art can be like very challenging, and you can have disagreements in the studio, or, you know, you can like a typeface and your graphic designer thinks it's abhorrent, and you know, that's, it's you know, but we learn about our, we learn skills.
Absolutely.
How to work with people.
No, and you can tell when there's a personal touch on it. Did you oversee the art on your records too, by the way?
Well, yeah. I mean, I oversee all the stuff. So so this one in particular, I work with a lovely graphic designer in Nashville, Jeremy Fetzer, who's also a really fantastic guitar player. But he does graphic design for us and for many other people. And he really got all my references. I wanted to do a kind of throwback to like a Dusty Springfield cover or a Francois Hardy cover. And
right.
And so that's what we did on this one.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. This was great. And it was great seeing you here recently, and seeing you here earlier than that when you were here with Robin at Space way back when we chatted. And I loved your music, and I love the spirit you bring to it. So thank you so much.
Thanks,
and
Mark. I really appreciate your interest and your enthusiasm for the music. It's wonderful. I'm super grateful.
That's all for episode 195 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Emma Swift for sharing her beautiful music, insights, and stories with us. You can buy The Resurrection Game on black, blue swirl, and lavender vinyl, CD, and digital download on our website, emmaswift.com. You also can find vinyl and CD editions of Blonde on the Tracks there, as well as all sorts of fun merch. She has a Bandcamp page as well. Swift is supporting Hitchcock at Chickiwawa in New Orleans on September 25th, The Atlantis in Washington, D.C. on November 20th, the Bowery Ballroom in New York on November 22nd, and the Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York on December 27th. She's also playing the Troubadour in London on October 20th. Tickets are available on the show's section of her website. She's on Instagram at Emma Swift Sings, and you can follow her on Facebook and Blue Sky, too. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who plays the Resurrection Game with a lot of what I do. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.